Blog Talk Radio.
Good man.
Which direction we are going?
That wrecked the El Camino. It would have been DWI.
We have reached a tipping point.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is the tipping point. I am Happy Harry Hardon. I'll explain that in a second.
What?
joined by the venerable Larry Goodman and the lovely Miss Rachel. Okay, I gotta explain obviously.
Please.
Whenever it takes like just 2 seconds for the intro to get played for Tipping Point, I'm always reminded of the movie Pump Up the Volume, where Christian Slater plays this sort of bootleg like ham radio DJ named Happy Harry Hardon. Is his like fake DJ name to throw off the feds. And it always just reminds me of when there's that delay, because there's the delay when they're trying to catch him and he's in the Jeep with the hot girl, and they're going to do the broadcast from the Jeep. And then his song finally comes on and like everybody cheers, all the rebellious teens are like, yay. So it just reminded me of that, which is incredibly convoluted. Though Happy Harry Hardon, Triple H, I don't know. Something's there. That's it all ties into wrestling. It all ties in. Larry and Rachel, how are you guys doing tonight?
Well, I was doing okay until that, but
That's a lie. So, Larry, you were a busy man. Can you tell us about why we wrestle? I mean, I'm sure any number of our listeners were really excited about why we wrestle. Well, I mean, they didn't do the full launch. That will be January 9th, I believe, if I've got that correct. This was sort of a soft opening, as they would say in the bar or restaurant business, right?
Yeah, it was, but we didn't even find out how Rachel was doing.
Oh, man. All right. I guess that's what people really want to know. Rachel, how are you?
Well, I guess we're not going to find out how Rachel's doing.
See, this is why we don't have nice things. This is why you can't be nice to women.
I don't know what happened there, but why we wrestle. They did, as you said, a soft opening with basically a trial run of everything production-wise and building-wise and all of that. And that aspect of it, I thought, came off very well. The show ran smoothly. The building is still, is not ready yet. And they had a good crowd.
Yeah, 120 with very few comps. I got to see that's got to be a success by any measure. Larry, I got a question about the building. You mentioned that, see, there's Rachel's dog, right?
I thought I was on mute. I'm so sorry. No, I thought I was on mute. I just realized. I'm going to go take care of that now. I want to hear more.
See how these broads are?
Hey, we're at 600 square feet. There's only so much I can do.
Larry, what was up with the building? What was different, and what is going to be changed?
The entrance to the ring is going to come straight down the middle from the dressing room, and it's not elevated anymore. That's already been taken down, so it's been brought down to floor level, if you will, so that the guys aren't coming down the ring.
Oh, okay.
And
gotcha.
Where the camera stand was, that is where the entrance has been cut through from the dressing room, but it's not ready yet. So there's basically, you can see this sort of like curtained off area where things are still under construction. So it had a half finished look in that respect. So the entrance is where it used to be, but that's not where it's going to end up being.
Gotcha. Wow, wow. So
the other thing about the show is that, you know, they announced some really good matches for this tournament. And the tournament's going to run from the first show in January, culminating with the finals at Hardcore Hell. So here's the thing that interests me about that. That's, what, six shows to get to Hardcore Hell, and you got a 32-man tournament. So you got 31 tournament matches, presuming they, you know, actually follow the brackets and there aren't guys that drop out for various reasons.
Sure.
So basically, the first six shows have to be very largely focused on this tournament. That's basically what they're going to be presenting in this tournament. And they've got some good folks in there. Corey Chavis is announced, Ace Rockwell, Masada returning to the building for the first time
yeah.
in 10 years. Masada versus Tank. Now, that's a must-see match, in my opinion. But the larger question to me is, what's the roster going to look like when this tournament ends? And the other thing was that did get messed up in the presentation, which got clarified in a later post, is that the Anarchy Championship is going to go away. It is going to be merged into the Why We Wrestle Championship by one of two means. Either Billy Buck's going to win at the December show and take that title into the tournament and defend it during the tournament, or if Kevin Blue wins in December and is the holder of the Anarchy Triple Crown, he's not going to go into the tournament and he's going to wait until the tournament's over and then wrestle the champion. But
and then do a
short,
unification of sorts, right? Do a unification of sorts,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, it's going to be unified, and there won't be an Anarchy Championship per se defended it separately after that.
So it's all a matter of really pulling this tournament off. It sounds like that's going to be the thing that they're hoping will bring people back show after show after show.
Yeah.
This is an impossible thing to call. Do you get the impression that the show that they put on Saturday is going to get people to show up in December? And how critical is that December show going to be to the makeup of things?
I guess if you really want to see Blue and Buck, which they did a good job of making that mean something,
yeah,
that'll get people to come back. However, a lot of the people in the crowd were not regulars, and how much that match means to those people, they would have had to have been sold on it by this one experience of the show last Saturday night. And that's my big question is, did you want to have a soft opening where you wound up getting new fans to come out and sample the product, but they didn't see the real product?
Right. I mean, it was a very, like, stripped-down locker room from what Anarchy's locker room once was.
Oh, yeah.
I guess we're just going to have to wait and see. Again, you know, it was probably nice to be back in that building and nice to shake some of the rust and the dust off, certainly, for some of the guys and things like that. It looks like Strychnine's going to get the major, major push, huh? He went over seven in less than 4 minutes.
Yeah. Yeah, that was pretty shocking that he went over so quickly, so cleanly.
Mm. Well, Todd Sexton getting a chance to book. Danny Only, of course, the owner. It'll be interesting to see what happened there. But AWE had a show on Sunday. Now, from all accounts, that building, that space, it appears to be packed, right? I mean, however many people they had, that's packed, 60, right?
Yeah,
and
you can't get much more than that in there, no.
I was surprised at, I mean, Wheeler's reaction right after was just basically like, maybe I'm going to take some time off, just basically saying he didn't think, I mean, I guess it's no big secret that they're taking a financial hit and have since basically the inception of that company, but this is my question, if it's packed, right, and I mean, this is assuming that most of those people paid, of course, but like, if it's packed, I don't get what the goal is. Like, do they, I don't know. It's a space where you can't fit 200 people, even if you tried. So what's the goal with AWE? I guess I don't know how else to phrase that, you know?
It could be set up certainly, and with standing room, you could get, like they did when for the Sabu show, you could get over 100 in there. But really, that's going to be about it. And, you know, is that enough to make it work financially? I think it is. And they're not, they've only hit that number that one time in that building. So maybe that's what he's hoping for, is to get it up to that crowd, up to that size regularly. Problem being, though, the people that come love the show, but it's the same people, basically, and it's not growing to any larger size than what it is.
Yeah, I noticed a couple of strange things. Like, it's weird. It's that crowd is their lifeblood, and it's also their curse. Like, I saw a thing where Corey put up a thing of, like, look, I promote the shows, and the wrestlers don't even promote the shows. I just don't get the sort of atmosphere of, I don't know, I just don't get their crowd thing. And maybe I'm not meant to get it, but Larry, what is your impression of the crowd? I mean, I know you're going to be loath to say anything bad, but, like, is that crowd their greatest asset or their greatest bane? I can't imagine 200 people ever sitting in a show putting up with that shit. I just can't imagine it. But maybe I'm wrong. What do you think? You're the one who's there, you know?
No, I don't think it's a negative for them at all. I mean, I think the people who come there have a great time, and I'm not sure that it would bother who it's going to bother, are people who don't want to hear four-letter words endlessly throughout the show. And there's a lot of that, both from the crowd and in the ring. And if you're bothered by that, yeah, I mean, there was a woman and her son sitting in front of me, and I don't know, maybe he was 12 years old, but I mean, like, yeah, this is definitely not a place for kids, in that sense. But I don't think it's a negative for them. It's somewhat of a negative for me personally, but I don't think it's a negative for AWE. But maybe we can get another opinion here, because there's someone else on the line who was at that show. Area code 770, I believe. Who is this?
What the hell y'all doing?
No, it's Jimmy Ox.
Yes. How's it going, guys?
It's going great, Jimmy Ox. Oh, Lord. And I know this is the real Jimmy Ox, is it not? This is absolutely the real Jimmy Ox, correct?
Who always squeezes your ass when they see you?
Oh, that's Jimmy Ox, all right. Jimmy Ox.
I've heard we've had some damn imposter been calling in on saying it was me.
Oh, no. That would be an incredibly poor taste. We would never do that.
Oscar been trying to cop. I think he's hacked into my damn computer because I've tried to call the last couple of weeks and my damn computer crashes every time I get on the damn thing. And then I miss because the guests come on before I can say anything.
Jimmy, I gotta ask you this while we have you on. You have your fingers, I say this all the time, you have your fingers on the pulse of wrestling in the state. You know what's going on with everybody, not just because you rent rings to just about anybody and everybody, but you just kind of have your ear to the grindstone. Let me ask you, what's sort of a hidden gem that's out there right now? Like, who's either a wrestler or a promotion that you think, you know, they're really doing great stuff and more people should check them out? Damn.
That's a catch 22. I think everybody's shows are down right now. I think a lot of people, and take for instance, I know a lot of people talk shit about old Chris Nims, but they ran a show in Milledgeville or somewhere and dropped 400 and some people with just regular guys, no big names or nothing on the card. So to me, the big names don't put asses in the seats, even with, you know, having the big name people there.
And yeah, I mean,
see that too. You know that yourself.
Yeah, I think they've borne that out lately. I mean, you know, Jim Cornette, as great as it was to have him at that Peach State show, I think it can be argued he didn't sell many tickets, if any at all. And Tommy Dreamer, same thing with AWE. Jimmy, if you've been known to run a show in the past, it's been a long time. If you were to run a show now, what's something you would make sure that you got done? What's something that you absolutely have to do nowadays to make sure your show is successful?
Oh, you got to get out and beat the bush with it now. You just can't rely on a lot of guys. I think a lot of the guys try and rely on Facebook.
Yeah.
You know, and it don't work that way. It probably has for some, but to me, I'm old school, and I love to do the old school ways of advertising, you know, talk to people. Sometime you might have to give 10 or 15 tickets away just to get more people to come, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Give some tickets away, because that'll attract some people, and hell, you might get two or three to show up. It's going to bring three or four with them by doing that and everything. But I think probably one of the best shows going right now is out of the state, and it's in Alabama. That would be that Global Championship Wrestling in Pearl City.
Yeah.
They got one of the best grand shows right now that's going, that I do once a month for them. They run once a month, and I think some of the guys run too many times and everything.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
I was listening to you talking about the Sunday show, and I'm like, Larry, there's too much of the cussing for me. There's some. Now, you know, hell, I've been to your shows, and you cuss up a storm, but a lot of it ain't cussing like they do periodically on the damn. You get excited about the match, and you let it be known, you know. And if you got the workers cussing back at the fans, then something ain't right somewhere, you know.
Mm.
Telling the fans to kiss their ass or whatever. but I'm like Larry, too. I don't see more than 150 at the most if they packed them in that little building down there.
Yeah.
And I think, not knocking Josh or nothing, I think he wants to draw the 250, 300, 400 plus for a show, and I don't see it happening. I don't see it happening.
Yeah.
Happening.
You know, we're going to have a guest on here pretty soon, but, you know, Ox, you always do grab my ass while Rachel is there, and that's the ass everybody wants to grab. Rachel, do you have a question for Ox?
Yeah, why do you always give Steve the attention and not me? I mean, that's
bullshit.
I knew that was gonna come out of her mouth for some reason. I have to tell you that in private the next time I see you. So.
Mm. Oh,
yeah,
that just feels weird. That just feels weird.
This must be something about the ring rental. So.
There's a heavy price to be in charge. Heavy is the head that wears the crown.
I can call him a bitch because he pays me.
Damn. Well, Ox, it was certainly something resembling a pleasure having you on. We got to bring you on proper as a guest sometime, definitely. Certainly a pleasure. And if I find that person who's impersonating you, I'll definitely let them know that is not okay.
I ain't going to kick their ass. I'm going to let the little one kick their ass, because I think he's as big as I am, bigger now. So he can... and by the way, by the time somebody straightens Matt Hankins' ass out.
Oh, thanks for that. My God, we've all been waiting for that. So.
Yeah, everybody else has probably been knocking you about it because you done it. I'm glad to see you put the foot down on that and say that it wasn't what Ryan said. It says Platinum Championship Wrestling, not the other damn shit.
Nicely done. God, finally someone who sees logic. The Rhodes Scholar. The Ox. Well, thank you again for being on, Ox. I'm sure we'll talk to you again real soon.
I want to listen to what Andrew.
Ladies and gentlemen, the one and only Jimmy Oxendine. And we're joined now by the booker of Empire Wrestling up in Rossville, Georgia, Andrew Alexander. Welcome to Tipping Point.
Thank you for having me.
Andrew, you know, I felt like we gave you guys short shift and did not talk about the incredible show that you guys put on. So I wanted someone from Empire on here, and who better than you? Tell us everything that went down and what you thought worked really, really well on the show that happened, not this last Saturday, but the Saturday before.
Oh, man, talking about everything that went down may take a bit too long. But, man, the thing that was the best about the show, and I'm not going to go into great details about why, because I hate to reveal everything about the wrestling business, but and a lot of people don't know it, but this show was an absolute train wreck. I wish I could say that it went off without a hitch, but I would absolutely be lying. It went through so many changes from the original plans and ideas to what actually took place. I mean, from months ago from starting to plan it. So the fact that, I mean, going into the show, I was thinking, okay, this is going to be our worst mega event that we've had. And maybe fans could say that it was, but I don't think it's fair to say because we really haven't had any of our mega events, in my opinion, flop or fail. There hasn't really been any bad ones. But, man, if you're judging by crowd reaction, it was arguably one of the best because the crowd got a lot of stuff to send them home happy. You know, a lot of times I like to make the people angry and to give them a reason to where they have to come back. And I think this reason they had to come back was just because the show was so awesome and so fan friendly that they had to go out and tell people, hey, you got to come to this show with me because it was just so. I mean, it was entertaining, baby faces on parade, you know, just sending everybody home happy. And the fact that we were able to pull that off when, you know, like I said, this show was just kind of a nightmare from start to finish. But the end product, the end result was pretty amazing. And, I mean, I think it's obvious that the boys on the card that night are – should get all the credit for that. But basically in the main event, it was looking like I was going to have to step up and step into the ring, which I definitely do not want to do, not out of some sort of cowardice, just because I don't want to be one of those guys like everyone else in the business who quit and then wrestles again. And it looked like I had a partner in Joey Lynch who obviously has been injured. His injury was re-aggravated, so he wasn't going to be able to be on my team. And the numbers were down, and it was all three members of the White Rose, Andrew Delight, just standing there in the cage waiting for me. And then out comes local hero Gunnar Miller, who Drew Delight had turned on and who had beat the hell out of, you know, an hour earlier in the night. He comes out and just the roof blows off the place, man. It was just insane. I've never been a part of the only reaction that would be similar to that would be some anarchy circa 2007-ish Shadow Mania, which is a pretty big compliment because the reaction was insane. And he came in and he just demolished everybody. And my team of Tank, Kyle Matthews, and Gunnar Miller ended up getting the victory there in War Games. And, I mean, it was just it was an awesome moment just because of that reaction. And it's hard to – I mean, even when you get good reactions on stuff, this was a whole nother level, and it's hard to experience stuff like that.
So, sorry. I want to ask a question kind of just from a booking standpoint and say as much or as little as you feel comfortable with, but how do you think that having a night like that where everything just – kind of falls apart, how do you think that has changed your perception as a booker or how you might prepare for a show?
Well, we have those nights all the time. Booking is an absolute nightmare. It's funny because I make the joke that not everyone in the wrestling business thinks they can referee and not everyone thinks they can manage. Not anyone thinks they can commentate, but everyone thinks they can book. Everyone thinks it's just this easy thing. And it's a nightmare. It's absolutely horrible. Anybody that does it for an extended period of time for any promotion deserves a hug or maybe a cuddle or something, because it's just a constant headache. And I've had these types of things happen all the time, and I think that's something that, I mean, to toot my own horn, something I'm good at is making chicken shit into chicken salad, because stuff changes. I mean, anybody can tell you that's been on any show. But sometimes stuff changes drastically and, you know, top to bottom, and there's always just problems. So that's something people that, you know, people that haven't booked or people that are on shows or even internet reporters, Goodman, should consider when they're watching shows and stuff, because they never – you never really know the full aspect of what has really happened to get you to what you're seeing. And, you know, it could be, if something goes horrible, you may be thinking, what were they thinking? And in reality, it may not have been what were they thinking. It may have been, it was 30 seconds before bell time and they were making changes. And, you know, unfortunately, that's part of the business. It's unavoidable.
Hey, Andy, I had a question for you about just a specific character, the Baniac. I mean, there was a guy who didn't seem like he was going anywhere at Empire, and he's got a pretty interesting role now. Could you just tell us a little bit about the development of the Baniac?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. He just... on top of being extremely small, which sometimes can hurt you, especially if you don't know how to carry yourself in that role, I wouldn't say he's as advanced as a lot of the guys that we've seen come through as far as in-ring work and psychology and things such as that. And that doesn't mean that there's not a place for him on the card. That doesn't mean that there's not a play. I mean, there's been tons of guys, not only in, you know, the WWE and huge wrestling organizations, but, you know, in Georgia, in the Southeast, that may not be five-star workers and may not have tons and tons of charisma, but that doesn't mean that there's not a place for them on your card or on your show. And, I mean, he's a perfect example of that, and he's also a perfect example of being given something. And instead of having the boo-boo face or throwing a fit or thinking this is beneath me, just taking it and embracing it. I mean, the Muji Bear was in his wedding, legitimately part of his wedding party, because he just took it and embraced it, and he runs with it. And now it's, I mean, what you see, that's him. You know, it's 100% real. So that's why I think it's, you know, been pretty successful, and he's definitely, I mean, you got to argue he's one of our most popular wrestlers/characters now.
Absolutely. So, you know, the big shows behind you, my question is, I know you have to go soon, when's your next big show at Empire? And, you know, I know you're loath to reveal too much, but where does it seem like the direction is going leading to that big show?
Well, I mean, we have a new heavyweight champion in Bobby Hayes, new tag team champions with Livewire Entertainment, so there's definitely some changes there. The next official big show should be at the end of January, long cold winter. But I've got some big ideas before then. We're going to do a big show we're calling Black Saturday, which is obviously the day after Black Friday. You know, that's just over a week away. Christmas night, we always have a show, and it's a pretty, you know, it's a pretty big event. In fact, our first quote-unquote mega event was on Christmas night many years ago. So that'll be a big deal. And then long cold winter at the end of January. And then it's just getting to Tooth and Nail 5 in April, which is our biggest event of the year, bar none. And got some good ideas for that. I think people are going to be, you know, pretty happy, pretty interested to see it, and that's what we're gearing towards now. And who knows, hopefully millions of things won't change between now and then, or cancellations or injuries or what have you. But I think there's some good stuff coming up. I think the best is definitely not behind us at Empire.
It is amazing how fast things go. I say that to people all the time whenever we talked about anything at PCW. And then, you know, and the conversation always ends, and then we'll be at Sacred Ground again. You know, it's just like, man, when you're really booking, and I would argue, I'll catch shit for this. I think there's four or five groups that book, and I think everybody else does some form of matchmaking. And Empire is definitely a group that books. It's amazing how much you can accomplish when you have a group of willing guys and women and a guy with a vision. And I think you definitely have a vision. Andrew, I can't thank you enough for coming on, and congratulations on pulling off a big show in spite of what sounds like were some pretty trying circumstances. Is there anything you want to leave us with?
No, I mean, I appreciate you guys having me, and it's always fun to shoot the shit about wrestling. So I definitely appreciate it. I know I didn't have a lot of time tonight, but I appreciate you having me on anyway. And anytime you want me to come on here and talk about Empire, just shoot me an invite and I'll be there.
Absolutely. Well, thank you very much, Andrew. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Well, that was awesome. Larry, I'm going to put this to you, and then I'm going to have a question for Rachel about Empire before I go into my awesome new segment. Larry, what's one thing you think Empire could use to really get their name out there? Because they're doing great stuff. They're doing just a crap ton of shows. But I got to be honest, often I feel like they sort of get overlooked when you talk about the scene in general just because of where they are. What's one thing you think they could do to get noticed a little more and maybe have some more people make the drive out there to see a show?
I wonder if it would help if their talent traveled more and got the Empire name out more that way. Like, you know, some guys have come to Peach State, Ryan Vega for one. Some have ventured into AWE. But really, they just stay in the Chattanooga area, so they're really not known in the rest of the state. That might help. I don't know that much is going to help to get people to do that drive, because it is from Atlanta, what, almost 2 hours to get to the building. So it's really, I think it really is more of a Chattanooga thing, and I don't think there's much that's going to change that. It's going to be the premier promotion of the Chattanooga area.
Rachel, here's my question for you. As somebody who's beginning to get out there more and you're doing shows seemingly here, there, and everywhere, what are the factors that determine whether you're going to do a show out of state? Are you in the mode of, you know, I want to get my name out there, so I'm going to do a show anywhere I can? Or what's your mind state when you're gonna pick a gig? Because a lot of people ask to book you, so I think it could be good information to get out there.
Right. Usually I approach other people, I think, for most of my bookings, and that's through talking to other wrestlers and saying, hey, what's a place that uses women for one? Because there are a lot of places that just don't, because there's not that, I guess, necessarily availability to have a good variety of women come in. So it's a matter of finding someone who actually has the woman to work, and then also a place that has a good reputation. I'm not looking for, like, the top promotion in the state to work, but I definitely look at kind of what the product is. Are they just matchmaking? Is it, you know, they just scrape the bottom of the barrel and find whoever they could? Because there are places that do that. And
yeah.
I want to avoid that just kind of so that I know I'm getting the best quality. And also, I've only been wrestling for about a year and a half, so I know I'm still green. I don't want to go somewhere where I could get hurt or someone else could get hurt because they have just, you know, not enough experience to really guide. I think it's important to learn from people, so that's another big one. Those are, I guess, the three main things I look for.
Cool. Well, are we ready for my new segment?
The world is not ready for your new segment.
The world is not ready. Since we don't have any music queued up for it, I have something on my iPad, which we're probably barely going to be able to hear, but it will amuse me. So let's hope it works. Here we go.
Dolphins, y'all don't dolphins.
Holy shit, it worked. So this segment is called Don't Be This Wrestling Person. And it's my arrogant advice based on some stuff I see online during the week. On Saturday, the big story in the UFC was Ronda Rousey lost to Holly Holmes, who was a 20-1 underdog. But looking back in retrospect, Miss Holm was kind of the perfect person to beat Ronda Rousey. Like, she had a great stand-up game. She's a boxer, kickboxer, just had real great skills. It's a great – it just had a great battle plan. You know, she obviously went in there ready. My opinion, Ronda Rousey got hurt, and then things didn't work. And then she went into panic mode and was just trying to beat her with one punch and just got picked apart and then finally knocked out with a particularly brutal kick that Holmes has used before. But immediately, because nobody is an expert on all things like a pro wrestling person, and it doesn't matter if it's an attack on Paris, it doesn't matter if it's the UFC, wrestlers always have an opinion, and they're usually terrible. So Taz and other wrestlers immediately hopped on there and said that the fight was obviously fake for any number of reasons. This is just my pet peeve with wrestling people. They think everything in the world is some kind of work, that every sporting event is rigged. I don't know how they would imagine this happens. I am so tired of hearing about everything's a work and Ronda Rousey should have won that fight and the story's better that she lost because blah, 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 blah. If you watched that fight, if you know anything about fighting, if you looked at the reactions from the shell-shocked Dana White, as well as Ronda, I mean, you look at all of that. I mean, Larry and Rachel, can you back me up on this? Is it not frustrating when wrestlers constantly claim that everything in the world is some kind of elaborate work instead of things just are?
You know, my opinion on it was, oh, no, I really like Ronda Rousey, and she lost. No way that she could be bad because I like her, and so I'm just going to say that she threw the fight or she's going to join WWE because that means I'm not wrong for liking her. A woman is allowed to lose.
Did you see the fight, Larry, by chance?
I did, and I just can't fathom how anyone could think that was fixed. I just don't get it.
You know, Taz famously came out and said it was fixed, but I just chalk that up to Taz. I mean, Taz has this podcast that he's trying to make a big deal, so he's going to say whatever to get publicity for it. That's what I would hope that I attribute it to. Then again, nobody takes their gimmick more seriously than Taz, of all people, who I think really convinced himself that he was like a UFC quality fighter. So yeah, I'm just done. So that's my segment for the week. I'm sure other things will flabbergast me during the week, and I'll have a different one next week. But yeah, wrestlers, everything is not a work. Okay, I want to talk about Nick Bockwinkel, of course. Nick Bockwinkel, for those that don't know, many-time AWA world champion, generally considered, I think, Larry, is this safe to say, if you had a top 50 all-time, and I know that that's a highly subjective thing, Nick Bockwinkel goes on the top, certainly the top 100 of all-time. But where do you place Nick generally in the pantheon of great pro wrestlers?
Well, he would easily be in mine, probably top 20 that I've ever seen.
Mm.
I loved Nick Bockwinkel, and of course I grew up in wrestling watching Nick Bockwinkel to some extent, so he'll always be near the top on my list. You know, he was a great wrestler, a great heel, a great talker. He was really a total package as a heel. So, yeah, on my list, way up there.
And you know, we're definitely going to give Bockwinkel his due, especially, and I think Trent's even calling in, so we can have a full-on Nick Bockwinkel love fest. But first, we got to talk about WWE and what's happening. Now, Larry, there's something that you wanted to talk about, correct, in regards to WWE?
before we talk about the Paige Charlotte thing?
Yeah, there's a number of things that are aggravating me, but I just cannot understand pairing Del Rio with Zeb Coulter. What are they thinking? What are they thinking? I just can't. Can either of you offer any kind of shed any light on what the thought process would be there?
No. I mean, especially in the light of this tournament, I mean, I'll just say it. Like, so Del Rio wrestled, you know, one half of the Lucha Dragons last night. And in retrospect, moving that Lucha Dragon guy against Del Rio was a smart move in that they can have a match that'll make Del Rio look great. Like, it's a guy that can keep up with Del Rio and be willing to jow. I mean, that works for me. But, you know, Zeb Coulter wasn't there because, like, having Zeb Coulter there feels ridiculous. My mantra is it's like they don't even know how to make money anymore. And I don't know, man. Like, the Zeb Coulter thing is weird, especially because Del Rio looks – phenomenal. I don't think he's ever looked better.
No. And it's not like the guy can't talk.
I don't get what there is. It because we got to use Zeb Coulter? And so here you go, Mex America. It's all very forced and very strange. I do want to segue into that Paige Charlotte segment. For those, I'm sure most people are familiar, but in case you're not, so It was a great moment in that they're having the Divas close out the show, something that hasn't really happened since, Trish wrestled Lita on the main event of Raw, which was a big, huge flipping deal. And how long ago was that? So you've got a contract signing, Paige the challenger against Charlotte the champion. And, you know, they were in a group together, and then Paige betrayed them on more than one occasion. And now she's going to get the title shot, and they're going to have a contract signing. And it's this Sunday, which I guess maybe they just felt the pressure to, you've got to do something big in your segment. Of course, it's a contract signing, so it's going to break down into a fight. But it's what Paige said right before they started fighting. In effect, you know, Charlotte, who had brought up Reed Flair earlier, in a segment that I actually found kind of disquieting already, when Charlotte started going for the heavy emotional punch right off the bat, I was like, there's something about this segment that feels very forced and clunky, kind of like, you got to go for something big, guys. It's this Sunday. You got to go for, you know, big, big, big. So she cut a very emotional promo, one of her better ones, I think. And then Paige, who also looked equally uncomfortable, says something along the lines at the end of, you know, you're going to quit just like your brother did. And, you know, Reed having died and, you know, suicide, and to bust out that line. And then they fought and they fought and they fought and they fought. But the backlash against that thing was tremendous, as one would imagine. But I don't, Rachel, like, I'm going to ask you first. Now, it's hard for women wrestlers, right? It's tough to sort of get a spot, especially a main event style spot. If you were, of course, you know, I'm not going to ask you some kind of weird hypothetical, but that's a tough spot. Obviously you would do what you were asked to do if you worked for WWE, of course, but what makes that segment okay? Are there situations where using Reed Flair being dead is acceptable? Am I being an old man about the whole thing? And just like, is it just, you know, is there any point at which that is okay? I guess, like, if it's Charlotte's idea or something like that, in your opinion.
I really doubt it's Charlotte's idea, because that's her brother. You know, that hurt never goes away. So I don't see her saying, hey, guys, I've got a great idea. Let's bring him up so we can fight. I mean, I think it was just something where the writers were like, we need something edgy and something going to really make people go, oh my gosh, I can't believe they did that. And the thing that bothers me is that somebody else signed off on that. Somebody higher than the writers had to sign off on that shit. And it is distasteful to Charlotte to have to be in it, to put Paige in that position, because neither of those girls can say no. I mean, we've seen when people say no in the past, then they, you know, oh, you're going to drop the belt, or oh, we're going to job you out for months, and then they have to worry about their job stability, because if they're getting jobbed out, their merchandise isn't selling, and then why would they keep them? So it's not a position where either of these girls can say, hey, I'm really not comfortable with this, or like, hey, it's still really too soon for me. And they just put them in this shit position where they kind of have to say yes. You're right. There's really no alternative other than I lose my dreams because I stood up for my values. It's a matter of how much they want to be there. I don't know what I would do in that situation, honestly, because that's the top. You know, once you're there, it's just downhill from there, or
yeah.
It's retiring from there. So, I mean, God, it's just, it breaks my heart for them that they had to go through that, you know, someone would ask them, even if it's 2 years, even if it's 5 or 10 years through that. It's disrespectful, and just, my dog is barking, so I'm going to get off of my soapbox and calm him down. But it just makes me so mad to hear about it, that someone will be put in a position where they're not able to say, hey, that's not okay with me.
Larry, let me just ask you a blunt question. Here's a blunt question. What's going on at the WWE? Like, what? Like, this just seems like a part of, I mean, the tournament isn't exactly lighting the world on fire. Just how it's sort of laid out. It the excitement is not in the air. And, I mean, is this the sign of a desperate promotion, or is it just another thing that's just was a bad decision?
It feels like they've lost their way in a lot of respects. I mean, they're still generating money. I'm sure they've got to be concerned about the declining TV ratings, no question. But I found it disturbing. I mean, Reed Flair only died 2.5 years ago. It's a heroin overdose. I mean, really? Is that really necessary? And if it is, that does seem pretty desperate. And I wondered, you know, there's just the overload, too, of having to do so much TV as they do. And I don't know if that just leaves them vulnerable to more poor decisions because they're the sheer volume of what they have to put out. But, I mean, I don't want to make an excuse for them because I don't think there is any excuse, really.
Yeah, it's certainly a tough time. It's a tough time for the WWE. And I don't know. I was talking to Jeff earlier, and he said it's kind of reminiscent of the Fritz von Erich heart attack thing they did in in World Class, where for those that don't know that horrible story, so they did a thing where they sort of recreated the Freebirds. They had this big cage thing, and then they had the new Freebirds attacking Fritz von Erich, and he gets a heart attack. Progress from the hospital would change depending on how the house went that week. So if the houses were down, Fritz would get worse as a way of sort of generating sympathy so people would buy tickets. It was seen as, I mean, even back then when there's still kayfabe and stuff, it was definitely seen as a sort of a crass, desperate attempt. The word crass was used in regards to the Paige Charlotte thing, and I think it's the perfect word. It's just whoever came up with it, whatever the intent, at the end of the day, it's about selling tickets. And they're, you know, the segment's happening in the third hour, which, yeah, is the main event spot, but realistically, it's the third hour of Raw that does the worst. So it's already in this sort of awkward position of, it's going to catch the blame if it's rated low, and it will be rated low inevitably. It has been for months, and then it's to pull that out. I don't know.
I don't know. It's a tough time for the WWE, no doubt about it. And one hopes that as they get to Royal Rumble and WrestleMania, that they can pull magic out of a hat. Something that bothered me recently, Larry, and then we'll definitely get into Nick Bockwinkel and end on the high note. But, you know, I was talking about WrestleMania, and I'm like, man, that's a lot of seats to fill, right? Like 100,000 seats. And then somebody just goes, yeah, they'll paper it. I mean, they've papered the last couple. And for some reason, that just struck me cold. Is that true? I mean, I don't know why. I felt like kind of a mark. I just always assumed WrestleMania was the go-to, that you could count on WrestleMania. And they're like, no, I mean, they're huge stadiums. So they've, you know, left stacks of free tickets in nearby hotels and things like that to make sure that they were full. And I don't know, that really just boggled my mind that you can't even count on WrestleMania to sell out anymore. And
yeah, and this, of course, this year they really have their work cut out for them with the size of the stadium. And by the way, the ratings were up a little bit last night compared to the previous weeks. However, the pattern remains the same, with the third hour being the lowest.
Yeah, and last week's, again, was the lowest, was the new worst 3 hour rating ever. So it's like, even when they climb out, I mean, for a little bit of perspective, they're drawing in the lower twos, which was what Raw was drawing during the beginning of the Monday Night War. Monday Nitro and Raw used to hover around like the 2.2s, and then the war ramped up, and then they could push segments into higher and higher numbers, which then sort of filtered down and lifted the shows up. And we're miles away from there, you know, we're just miles away from there. So it'll be interesting to see what they do. And I mean, one thing that I, you know, everybody complains about Raw, but one thing I was a little sad about, more disappointed, is I wanted them to kind of do more about Nick Bockwinkel. I feel like, just in the same way I thought they should have devoted a show to Piper, since he was the quintessential WWE performer for decades. But Bockwinkel, though he wasn't a WWE performer of any kind of note, he's a Hall of Famer. He's just that guy. Is Trent on the line, Larry?
He is, yes.
Oh, let's bring him on. Trent, right off the bat, Nick Bockwinkel, man, like when you think Nick Bockwinkel, what do you think of immediately? What are memories that come to your mind?
Well, the first thing comes to my mind is I want to slap you across the face for saying he's one of the top 100. I defy you to name 99 pro wrestlers better than Nick Bockwinkel, Stephen Platinum. Let's hear your 99.
George Hackenschmidt.
Name five pro wrestlers that are the complete package, that are actually better than Nick Bockwinkel.
So you're gonna say Nick Bockwinkel was top five? Wow, wow!
No! I'm saying he's number one. I'm saying he's the best of all time. Now I'll say subjective. I'll admit that's subjective, but anybody that doesn't think that is wrong.
What about Nick Bockwinkel does it for you? What about Nick Bockwinkel? Tell us about your memory of seeing Nick Bockwinkel. What is it about him?
In 1972, him doing promos on AWA TV with Marty O'Neill, and he was using such large words that little 7-year-old Trent Van Dries had to pick up a dictionary to figure out what he was saying. That's what was doing that. He just had the look. You know, he just exuded class, but he was also arrogant. Everybody knew he was good, but yet they hated him. One of my big pet peeves in wrestling, the last couple of shows you talk a lot about wrestling people, in wrestling, Steve, is everybody always says that the heel cannot be a better wrestler than the babyface, or cannot be more skilled than the babyface. Bullshit! Nick Bockwinkel was more skilled than the Crusher, more skilled, you know, than Mad Dog. Well, maybe not Mad Dog, but more skilled than a lot of the brawlers that he faced. And the fans knew it, and that made the fans hate him even more. I would equate it in modern times to something along the lines of Tom Brady and the Patriots. Everybody hates the Patriots and Brady, but does anybody think they're actually bad at their job or not skilled? Of course not. They just think they take shortcuts and cheat, and they're smug and arrogant, right? You know? Bockwinkel had the perfect look for a world champion, carried himself like a champion.
Yeah.
He's in shape. Sensational interview. And one of the reasons that I think Bockwinkel was the best of all time, and it is arguable, but unlike, let's just say, a Ric Flair or a Bret Hart or a lot of guys, Bockwinkel tailored his match for his opponent. He did not have the same match over and over and over and over. And that alone puts him on top of the scale.
Mm-hmm.
Unlike so many guys that had the same match, no matter what, Bockwinkel did not do that. If he had a match with Ricky Martel, it was a 20-minute fast-paced match. Or Curt Hennig, he's 50 years old, having a 60-minute slobber knocker with Curt Hennig. You know, a match with Mad Dog Vachon, a match with the Crusher, a completely different match. And Bockwinkel always made everybody in the ring look good. And yet he was perfect at looking vulnerable, but he never looked bad. He always looked the perfect champion. You know, he always looked vulnerable, but he never looked bad. It's like, damn, I thought he could get him that time. He was just the man, you know.
Here's something about Nick Bockwinkel that I never hear said, but I feel like it should be said. Bockwinkel, to me, once he wasn't wrestling anymore, there was almost nobody better at talking about wrestling, either when I would see him at Cauliflower Alley Club or just on that AWA DVD that the WWE put out. He was so skilled in how he just talked about wrestling. I remember him talking – when he was talking up Bobby Heenan, and he went, Bobby could do what I could do. And he could do what Ray could do, but we couldn't do what Bobby did. Like, who was better at sort of putting guys over? Who was better at, again, I said this to Larry. I don't know if you heard it, Trent. Bockwinkel, to me, was the last champion for the AWA that you could consider on par with the other ones. That after Bockwinkel's era, and this is not a knock against Curt Hennig or Lawler or whoever, but I don't think that you could credibly say the AWA title was a world title once Bockwinkel didn't have his hands on it anymore. I think he was the last of the great era guys for the AWA.
And really what's interesting about that to me, Stephen, is the tie in there is Hulk Hogan. Because when Hulk Hogan left the AWA, to me, after that, it was Weekend at Bernie's after that, this last 7-8 years. It was never one of the same. And it was Bockwinkel versus Hogan in so many matches. I saw those matches in Green Bay several times. And, you know, they did the old dusty finish in Minneapolis where Hogan pinned Bockwinkel. The crowd's going bananas. And, you know, then the next week on TV, all fans, Stanley Blackburn has to inform you that Hulk Hogan was disqualified for throwing Nick Bockwinkel over the top rope. And I think that, you know, that after a while, the fans got a little sick of that. And then when Hogan left, the AWA just had, you know, just too many old guys around, including Bockwinkel. You know, he was still great, but, you know, too many old guys around. And that's when Vince McMahon was taking over the world. And, you know, it was just kind of a perfect storm at that point, I think. But
you know, and I mean, the story goes that Vern Gagne just didn't think Hulk Hogan was a good enough wrestler to have the AWA title. What's interesting to note is Vern, who sort of famously put it on himself for good reasons, so maybe not all the time, but Bockwinkel is the one guy who was completely credible to beat anybody. And I think that's a testament. You know, he was the one guy that you believe could beat Vern.
And the thing is, I'm glad you said that because I wanted to bring this up. And this is a real key point for wrestling today, that's something that wrestling is sorely lacking. You know, when Nick Bockwinkel won his first AWA title, world title, in 1975, he was almost 41 years old. You know, back then, wrestlers peaked in their late 30s and early 40s. Nick Bockwinkel's peak was from ages 40 to 50. Nowadays, you have WWE cutting guys in their 20s, you know? I mean, who in their late 30s is legit going to get a shot? You know, you need to – and by the time Bockwinkel got to the AWA in the early 70s, he'd already been wrestling for 18, 14 years, had, you know, a long apprenticeship, he was ready for it. You know, I don't know, a lot of times, Stephen, these guys in their 20s that they cut, you don't know what they're going to be. They haven't,
no, you don't.
They haven't developed. You know, it's like, for, I'll give you an example. It's maybe not a great example, but take like a Bobby Lashley. You know, not that he's the greatest pro wrestler, but the past couple of years he kind of has found himself as a pro wrestler.
Oh, marked improvement,
you know?
No doubt about it.
You know,
no,
yeah.
He's a star now, and they always tried to make him one before, and he wasn't. And now he is.
Yeah,
he's a star.
So, you know, it's just so crazy to me that, you know, they want 20-year-olds on TV where really if they let these – of course, there's no territories, I get it, but if they let these guys cook for – a long time, you would really, you know, let's do it like, you know, you put oatmeal on the stove. Well, it takes a long time for the cream to rise to the top. It doesn't just happen in 2 minutes. You know what I mean? It takes a long time before you see who the cream really is. And now, you don't know, you know. So that's, but yeah, Bob Mickle's salad years were 40 to 50 years old.
And Larry,
you know, you mentioned Bobby Heenan. Think about that. You know, I defied you to name 99 better wrestlers. Name me one better manager-wrestler pairing in wrestling history than Bobby Heenan and Nick Bockwinkel. Mm. Name one. And think about this. Historically, the reason a guy had a manager was because he couldn't talk. You know, Heenan was maybe a better talker than Bockwinkel. Bockwinkel did not lack on the mic at all. One of the better promos in wrestling history. So think about that. You had a pairing of two guys that were expert talkers, and yet this pairing was magic. It was a magical pairing. So, but it was just so odd that they would put a guy that could talk so well with a manager.
Yeah, yeah. Larry, can you give me a Nick Bockwinkel memory?
I'll give you two. When Heenan left AWA. In the late 70s and brought Bockwinkel to Atlanta with the AWA title. I was on cloud nine seeing those guys in the city auditorium and the heat they got. Tremendous, tremendous stuff. The other one is, of course, how many guys could have the kind of match quality Bockwinkel had when he was in his 50s. He and Hennig took that AWA title on the road and came to Georgia in the late 80s. And, you know, I mean, you know, Bockwinkel wasn't at Hennig's level at that stage of his life, but he could he could still go with him. And those were some great matches to see Bockwinkel and Hennig have when Bockwinkel was, what, 52, 53 years old.
Yeah. I'll tell you something, too. This is just funny. But back in the very first live wrestling I attended in May of 1976. And back then there were a lot of Laotian people in Green Bay. And I just happened to sit down next to him. And it was the first time I seen a ring. I was just, you know, I was completely in awe. And I was just listening to these people talk and they were going, man, why you, Bobby Heenan, woo, are you, Dick Bockwinkel, woo, Bobby Heenan. And I thought, damn, these are the stars. I couldn't understand one word they said except Heenan and Bockwinkel. That's all they were talking about.
When I was when I first opened my own wrestling training thing in 2001, because, you know, my house or where I lived was very close to the gym, it wasn't uncommon for me to have the trainees kind of come to my house and hang out. That was sort of a normal part of the bonding. And I remember throwing on Henning Bockwinkel. Because I was having a debate about, you know, somebody was like, you know, what's your favorite match of all time? And because they're all younger, of course, like their memory is, oh man, you know, Bret Hart, Shawn Michaels, you know, 1 hour at WrestleMania. And I just went, you know, there's better. And they assumed I was going to bust out some Ric Flair match. Right. And I said, take a look at this. And keep in mind of how old this guy is, how young this guy is, and the expert job that Bockwinkel is doing in making Henning. You know, Flair gets a lot of credit for making guys. I don't think Bockwinkel gets nearly as much credit for the stunning number of guys that he made, up to and including, you know, some of the biggest stars ever. I mean, who taught Hogan how to work? Right? I mean, taught Hogan, you know, like Vern always takes credit for, I'm the one who told him to flex and show his shit. Who taught him how to be a main eventer?
Who taught him how to be a main event face? Who taught, you know, how many guys did Bockwinkel work with that he made great? And Henning, who, I mean, I don't know if people think that he was just spit on a stump and hatched, but there were guys that helped make Henning great. And Bockwinkel, I think, first and foremost amongst them. Pretty impressive.
I did want to ask you, Stephen, did you ever get a chance to see Nick Bockwinkel in Hawaii? Because Bockwinkel loved Hawaii.
I absolutely did.
Yeah,
I was just going to say, I went to an AWA card where Bockwinkel wasn't the champ. So he just worked. They had him work a local guy, which I found really strange because it was an AWA card. On top was the Midnight Rockers against Stan Hansen and Terry Gordy in what I now recognize as we're going to beat the shit out of these young punks, which is what it was. And then Sherry Martel wrestled, which I was really excited about. And then there was Bockwinkel wrestling a local guy. Here's the interesting thing. Because of how Bockwinkel carried himself, and I can only chalk that up to that and the fact that it was sort of known that he loved Hawaii, they cheered for Bockwinkel. It was just one of those things where he was like the genuine star that they would not boo. And you could see that it kind of threw him. I just remember that going like, oh, he's kind of thrown. Because, I mean, they were just, for them, it was seeing – he was the biggest star there. It didn't matter where he was on the card. And he was wrestling a local guy. So there definitely were guys that were rooting for the local guy, of course. But really, people genuinely just sort of responded to Bockwinkel of, this is probably the only chance we're going to get to see this guy in person. And they gave him a star's ovation. I'm quite sure that he was supposed to go over dirty, but instead they just had him go over clean and work babyface. And, he sort of did this is awesome too. So he went back to the locker room and people were cheering. And he came out and kind of did a tip the hat thing. And I remember thinking how cool that was. They just said, dude, they're still cheering, go out there. And so he went out there and kind of did like a tip the hat and, people cheered more. And I remember thinking, how great was that? Like, I brought my, you know, Pro Wrestling Illustrated that, like, who's the greatest? You know, is it Bockwinkel or Flair or Hogan or whatever? I guess to get him to sign it, but more just sort of recognizing I got to sort of check one of the greatest off my bucket list, you know? That's how it felt at the time when I was, you know, all of 16. So.
You know, go ahead.
Go ahead, Larry.
We remember not to mention that Bockwinkel was also part of one of the greatest tag teams in history. Nick Bockwinkel and Ray Stevens, managed by Bobby Heenan, was just off the charts.
Oh, yeah, that's one of the best teams ever, obviously, yeah. It's just, you think about the level of talent in that trio.
Yeah.
It's staggering.
Yeah.
It's staggering. I mean, think about the level of talent in that trio. It's staggering. I'll tell you a Bockwinkel memory that just popped in my mind from that same era you're talking about, Stephen, in the mid-'80s. Bockwinkel in Green Bay wrestled a singles match against a young and extremely green Scott Hall. And it wasn't a particularly good match, and it maybe went 7 or 8 minutes, but what stuck out to me, and this is something you never saw in Green Bay, all of a sudden I looked back, you know, toward the locker room door. And Brock Hardy Arena, the locker room door was quite a long ways from the ring and very dark. But when I looked back there, I saw the entire roster outside the locker room watching the match. So the entire lot, everybody was standing there watching. So obviously, even, you know, at that age, you know, 19 years old or so, I thought, 20 years old, I thought, okay, something happened where Bockwinkel said, watch how the master does it, boys. Something along those lines, you know, with a green guy. So, and Bockwinkel won the match with a small package, but it was just, you just never saw that back in those days, you know. The whole locker room out watching the match, you know. It more than sold out the curtain, it sold out in front of the curtain, you know. So,
Bockwinkel, yes, sir.
And this is just me, but I posted this on my board too, but just imagine this, guys. Had Bockwinkel been 10 years younger, maybe even 5, but just say 10 years younger, and this is no slight to Ted DiBiase, But tell me he would not have been the perfect million-dollar man.
Oh, yeah.
Perfect.
No question.
Absolutely.
He could have brought nuances and authenticity to that role nobody could have.
Well, and imagine if he was 10 years young. I mean, just him having a sustained WWF run would have been amazing. I think he's the one guy that you can – because that was that era of the WWF where really they just cherry-picked the best from everywhere and threw them in the cauldron together. It's an amazing thing that will never happen on that scale again.
Yeah. Oh, no.
And it's a shame that you didn't get to see Nick Bockwinkel mix it up with some of those guys. I can't imagine the entertaining value. I remember I used to do this thing called Timeless where I just sort of picked like a ridiculous amount of wrestlers, like more than 100. And then I just bracketed them off and I would just write what would happen if Bruiser Brody wrestled Triple H when they were in their primes, what would happen, blah, blah, blah. And I had Nick Bockwinkel against Jake the Snake. Now, it was just one of these, like, sort of, like, thrown together. Okay, I need to take two guys that I haven't written about yet. And that one, I remember, got the most response. Like, people wrote in droves. Like, either outraged at the finish or just like, oh, man, you know, I have – and people had their Nick Bockwinkel memories. And I just thought that that was so great that, you know, most people were reading, I thought were just younger people who were going to read to see how long I was going to let, you know, CM Punk advance, right? But instead it was like, oh, Nick Bockwinkel, so cool. Yeah, that would have been a great match, you know?
But and you know, and if you want to talk about Tennessee, to this day, people still talk about Bockwinkel and Lawler. Bockwinkel may have been Lawler's best opponent.
Hmm.
In fact, Lawler openly says Bockwinkel is the best world champ that he ever faced. Bockwinkel and Lawler just had perfect chemistry. You know, both kind of, I mean, Lawler's babyface, but he's also a wrestling heel and very cerebral. They just, those two in the ring were, oh my God, they were just a match made in heaven in the ring. And people still talk about that as one of Lawler's, you know, if you talk Terry Funk, Bill Dundee, you got to put Bockwinkel, Lawler's top five opponents, you got to.
You know, we're definitely running over time, and we definitely wanted to hear Nick Bockwinkel, so we actually put together an Izzy High with a Nick Bockwinkel promo. So then, I'm pretty sure we can all agree that he's probably not high, but at least we can sort of talk about the greatness of the promo.
Sure,
It's time to play Is He
High? Talked about a fucking pound of weed and played a bunch of video games.
Weed is tight. Weed is tight. That's awesome.
I cannot stand the way I have been treated. You take two of the biggest goons that professional wrestling or the sports world or the world in general has got. Why don't they become a couple of terrorists, far as I'm concerned? Stanley Blackburn, you allow these men to go wild. In front of 18,000 people who cheered you humanoids cheered them on while they beat us to death with a metal chair. I have got knots all over my head. I've got a split elbow. I'll tell you what. I won something. I'm not putting the championship up anymore. You can go drop dead, Wally Carbo, but I do want to have a little bit of satisfaction. If this is the way it's got to be done, then let these two gentlemen step back into the ring, and I will get myself a partner. If you want to play dirty, if you want to play nasty, if you want to play evil, and you want to play vicious, then I'll tell you what. That is exactly what the world's heavyweight champion is going to become. Because I'll tell you, you people are setting the standard. Wally Carbo, Stanley Blackburn, you are allowing our whole sport to be denigrated by no people like Mad Dog Vachon and the Crusher. Who do they think they are?
I'm going to that fucking match. I'm going to that fucking match.
and that was far from Bockwinkel's best promo. But, Steven, I do have to say that Bockwinkel was high there because he's number one.
I don't think it can get better than that. Thank you very much, Trent Van Dries. Larry Goodman, Miss Rachel, I'm Stephen Platinum. Rest in peace, sweet Prince Nick Bockwinkel. You made the wrestling world better then you found it, and for that we are all grateful. Thank you, and join us next week on The Tipping Point.
Child
needed
a dictionary to figure out those
problems. Thank you for listening to this broadcast. Production brought to you by the GWH Radio Network.
Well, I mean,
for the latest information on upcoming events.
Nowadays, if a champion doesn't defend his title in a tag match, it's seen as a cheap thing. He made it that it was like, well, fuck, I know, I'd rather see the tag match. Just expert. So
not
expert.
Only that, my mother, who despised pro wrestling, I was banned from watching it at various times. She even thought Bob Winkle was sexy. What about that?